And if you're just tuning in, this is KDLL Public Radio 91.9 FM, Kenai, Soldotna. You're listening to a pre-recorded conversation with Al Hirschberger, a Soldotna resident and World War II veteran. Can you tell us a little bit about some of the people in your unit? To remember some of them, maybe?
Oh, my goodness. Well, we had all kinds of people in there, of course. And one of them that he used to sing songs and tell stories. His name was Lawrence Parker from Parsons, Kansas. And he had an old Kansas drawl or whatever. And he would tell stories. And he would always come up with a joke. And when there were times, you know, when we were told that tomorrow we're going to do this or that, and we were scared of whatever is going to happen, you know. And I know the very first day we went in combat, we were occupying a library in Germany. Offhand, I can't remember the name of the town. And there were at least a dozen of us in this library, books all around us. It was a university library of some kind. And nobody was saying anything, but Parker was telling jokes. He was a little hard to do them. You could tell that he was stressed, but he would tell jokes, and we'd laugh a little bit. But most of the time, he'd tell stories, and we'd laugh at just the way he told them. But there were all kinds of people in there. There were some that just never talked. We had two Parkers, Parker E and Parker L. Those were the only two people in the battery that had the same last names. Parker L was Lawrence Parker from Parsons, Kansas. Parker E was Edmund Parker, and he was from southern Indiana. And Parker L was a loud mouth, you might say. He talked all the time and told jokes and was talking all the time. Parker L never said much. He always kept to himself.
Same name.
Parker E, I'm sorry, yeah.
Same name, very different.
Very different people, yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. I'm sure they weren't related, yeah.
Did you have a nickname?
No, everybody went by their last name. Well, I've got the roster, so I look at them, and it's interesting. But we had Grossberg and Humphreys and Parsons and Parker E, Parker L, and just a whole bunch of them. And I go through the roster every now and then, and well, see, that's how I can Google their names, and so there I found their obituaries, a lot of them, and. Curtis, Reuben E. Curtis, and he was a big loudmouth from Oklahoma, I believe. And when he was big, and he was when he spoke, you heard him. And I'm Reuben E. Don't wait up for me.
Wow. When you think about your time, what are some of the things you think about? It sounds like you have a lot of positive memories from that time of your life.
I do. And one thing that I've learned, that most people who have been in combat or had anything to do with combat, they remember well the fun times. They don't really remember well the bad times. And you don't necessarily intentionally do that, but it happens. I know that in 1972, I believe, I took my wife, my two daughters, and another girl who was a friend of my daughter's to Germany. And we rented a car. We went to Hungary, Czechoslovakia, and Germany. But I went to various different places, and I was saying that I remember this place here. I remember the first sergeant had his stash of whiskey in this building here, and I got crawled under the door and got some of it. And other things, you know, what we did here and what we did there. And then Reva, the girl that was my daughter's friend, she says, "Is that all you guys did was go around and have fun?" I said, "Well, you got to remember, while we were having fun, there were people shooting at us.
Coping.
But we remember the good things and the fun things. We don't remember the shooting.
Why do you think that is?
It's built in. It's not something you intentionally do. It's built in to prevent you from, that's part of your body's defenses. I'm not a psychologist, of course, but it's built in. I did not intentionally try to forget things and try to remember things. It just worked that way.
What was it like going back and visiting? Was that your first time back?
And actually, my first time back was in 68. And I've been back two or three times since. And in 72, I went back because I wanted to go to the place where I was when the war ended. I had not been there before. And so I took a picture of it, the railroad station. And every 8th of May, I post that on Facebook and my little story that goes with it, which I did just recently. And so I've not been to all of the places I've been. Some of them I couldn't remember exactly where they were anyway, but I've been to where we were the most, yeah.
Why the 8th of May?
That's the end of the war in Europe.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I know there aren't a lot of World War II vets who are still living,
mm-hmm.
but are you able to talk about these things with folks who fought in other wars? Do you find there's a community of veterans from across different generations?
We do a little bit, but not that much. We don't, you know, it's usually you, again, when you're talking to other veterans who were not even with you from other wars even, generally speaking, you talk, not even thinking about it, you talk about the fun times and the positive times, not about the bad times. Mm-hmm. They come up a little bit, but you don't usually dwell on them. And again, I think that's our body's way of coping. Mm-hmm. Some can cope better than others, but generally when I talk with other veterans, we don't really bring up the bad stuff.
And do you ever think or worry about stories of people who lived through these times not getting passed on? Do you think there's a sufficient storytelling tradition that passes these stories on?
In my case, I have a grandson who is a World War II fan. He has been. He's 16.
A history buff.
He's 16 now. And he always wanted to, when he was little, he'd come down and he wanted to see my war souvenirs. And I had all kinds of them, German Iron Cross, German medals, German helmet, German pistol, German rifle, all kinds of stuff. And for his birthday 2 years ago, I gave him the German helmet.
How great.
Oh.
He must have loved that.
He was sitting there at the table, and I had it in a box about like this, and I gave it to him, and he opened it up, and I was sitting right opposite from him, and for real? You're not kidding? For real?
Wow.
Yes, it's yours.
Wow. So you think
I gave him my books, too, that World War II books. In fact, this Dave that was just here a little while ago, he gave me one about aircraft in World War II, and he says, that's for Sam, my grandson. So the last time they were down, I gave him that. And I've got a lot more that he'll get. So I give him stuff all the time. And now he is pretty much the only one in the family. Of course, I have two grandsons, and the other one is older, and he hasn't got that much interest in World War II. But Sam does, and I don't really know why, but he does. So it these things pass down through. Yes, they do. Maybe not enough, but they do. Mm. And
wow. So I find it so amazing that you are able to use the internet to find these people.
I do too. Yes, I do. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
I think I found one of the lieutenants in Michigan, Lieutenant Petoskey. He was the best officer in the whole battalion, in my opinion, and a lot of other people's battalion too. And he was well known in conservation circles. He had a degree in forestry when he was in the Army and when he was in World War II. I'm not sure. I think he did, yeah. And so for a while he was, he was a deputy of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife something, I don't know. He was in Washington, D.C. and had quite a history of conservation and various things. And so I knew of him, and then I finally found his phone number and called him. And then I did a book on my battalion and our battery. And I said, I got the book that I'd like to send it to you. Oh, yeah, sure. So what I did is on the inside, I always put a whole page. This copy, especially printed for Lieutenant Petoskey, the best officer in the whole damn battalion. And that's the truth. Mm. And he said when he got that, he said it brought tears to his eyes. But when our battery battalion broke up and went different ways right after the war, the officers got us all together in one room and they all talked. We had the battery commander was a captain, he's all executive officers, Lieutenant Anderson, and then there was another lieutenant, and then Lieutenant Petoskey. And they all were saying goodbye to us, and Petoskey broke down in tears. He was the only one that was emotional. We were all emotional, but he was the only one that got a standing ovation, of course, because he actually broke down in tears. So anyway, when he got this, he sent me a letter back. I still have the letter somewhere. He says, when I opened the book and read what you wrote, it brought tears to my eyes.
What made him such a good officer?
I don't know. He didn't lord it over you. He was your friend, you know, and it's just hard to say. And when I got in the battalion, the battery in Fort Jackson, South Carolina, he and Corporal Gregory were on an advanced trip. They were already in France getting preparation for us coming over. So when I got there, they said, now there's two more in the battery that aren't here. That's Corporal Gregory and Lieutenant Petoskey. And Lieutenant Petoskey is one great guy. The enlisted men told me that. The officer didn't say that, of course. And they didn't say that in front of the officers either. But anyway, so when I was expecting a good officer, he came on board ship before we got off the ship in France. He came on and he shook hands with me and greeted me and wanted to know where I was from. And I was from northern Indiana and he was from central Michigan, so we weren't too far apart. But anyway, and I can't really call him a close friend because we weren't. He was the motor officer most of the time. He did other things too. And so all of the guys in the motor pool, they were closer friends to him than I was, but he was just a good officer. He was just a good officer, yeah.
Why did you decide to write a book?
I wanted my kids to remember what I did. Mm. And I also wrote it for the survivors at the time that I could get a hold of. So I mailed this copy of this book out, and I printed them myself, so it's not easy to do. And besides, it's on five or six different computers now with the programs changing and everything. But anyway, I passed out. Anytime I meet somebody online or I got somebody from the battalion, I sent him a copy of the book. And I also, this book got put on the internet. So not, the book wasn't on the internet, but it was the fact that it was a book. I got letters, emails from people all over the, well, not all over the country, but I would guess probably a dozen altogether. The last one I got was from a couple in Washington, and the wife, her father was a first sergeant in one of the batteries. I didn't know, didn't remember him, and he had died 2 months before she was born, so she didn't know much about him. So she found out that I was in the 670th. Online she found this. And then I said, well, I did do a book on it. Oh, can I have it? Yes, so I did. I sent it to her. And they sent me a real nice letter. And she said that she now knows what he was like. And to some, even though I didn't personally know him or remember him, she knows what he went through. Mm-hmm. And or some of the things he went through. And also, there was a first sergeant in B Battery, right at, and the war ended. He wrote a history of the battalion. I included that in my book. It's not very lengthy, and it wasn't too much of a book, but it's enough, it tells you some of it. But anyway, this woman was so happy to get this. I got another one from a woman in Alabama or Georgia one time, and she said that her father died when she was 15 or 16, I think, and he was in the battalion, and she said, I was too young to ask him questions. I never thought about it. Now that I'm older, I wanted to know what he did, and this has helped her tremendously, and she had a very nice letter. Mm-hmm. Whenever I needed my ego boosted, I'd read her letter. You know, I was thinking about this morning. There's always regrets in life. Wish you'd have done something a little bit different. Well, when I was getting ready to go overseas, and we were in Boston, or we were at Camp Miles Standish, not far from Boston, and we had... We could get one pass to Taunton, Massachusetts, and I did. So what I should have done was bought a camera and film, because they told us from now on you can take pictures all you want. Mm. But prior to that, they didn't want us to take pictures on our movement up to the Boston and everything. But from now on, and when you get on the ship, you can take pictures. I didn't have a camera, didn't really know how to use one. I had a little box camera when I was a kid, but I didn't have a good camera. And what I should have done is take my leave time and go to Taunton and find a camera place. There were always were camera places somewhere selling cameras. Get a good camera, a bunch of film, and learn how to use it. No, I didn't. I went with my buddies and got drunk. That was a one regret. Because I could have, it was...
You wouldn't be an 18-year-old if you didn't do that.
Well, but I did finally, I found a camera in a pile of POW belongings. When these POWs were captured, they would load them onto trucks and take them to a POW camp somewhere. And they had to throw their stuff away other than minor little things. There was a huge pile of stuff there in this one town in Germany, Ludenscheid. And I was wading through it, and that's where I found the Iron Cross that I gave to my grandson, and I found his little camera. Then I had a hard time finding film for him, but I did finally get film for him. But by the time I got film for it, I think the war was pretty much over with, and a lot of opportunities I had getting better pictures were gone. So I didn't get take pictures early enough. And it's always bothered me.
Al, is there anything else you would like to add that we didn't talk about?
Oh, I don't know. I have a lot of things to talk about, I guess. But I really value my experience. There's something else I didn't tell you. My first language was German. So I was the interpreter.
Really?
Yeah. Actually, it was a Germanic dialect. I come from an Amish family.
Wow.
And my first language was Pennsylvania Dutch, which is a Germanic dialect. So when we got into Germany, Captain Smith said, "I understand you speak German." I said, "Well, a little bit. I speak a Germanic dialect." "Okay, you go with me." So I did. And like I say, I didn't know the High German all that well on anything, but I learned fast. I was young and I was a good fast learner anyway. I learned German fast, but I was the first guy we stopped on the road to ask him some questions about finding something, and was a guy on a German on a bicycle. So I started talking, and the German started talking. He didn't understand half of what I said. I didn't understand what he said, but anyway, I did find out what we were looking for, and I forget what it was. And so then when we started to leave, Lieutenant Anders says, "Boy, you really do talk that stuff." What he didn't know was I wasn't understanding half of what the crowd said, and the crowd wasn't understanding half what I said. But you can say anything you want. The captain would believe it. But I learned fast. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it did help in a lot of ways that there were times when we had missions to deliver ammunition that were considered somewhat dangerous, and they didn't send me. And another time, Lieutenant Anderson and Captain Smith and Sergeant Sullivan and I were in this German building. It was a town hall or something in this town that had just been captured. And it was a big open floor there, and down towards one end of it, there was an Army GI overcoat. And Sergeant Sullivan said, "Boy, I could use that overcoat." His had just burned in a fire just a day or so before, and it was still cold. And so Captain Smith said, "Whoa, wait a minute, that might be booby-trapped," because it was kind of piled up, you know, it wasn't just laying flat. And everybody stood there and looked. And I said, "Oh, I'll go get it." And I started to walk up there, and Lieutenant Anderson grabbed me by the shoulders. He yanked me back. He says, "I'll go. You're more valuable to the battery than I am." So he went up, very carefully picked it up. It wasn't booby-trapped. And Sullivan got a new coat, or a coat.
Wow.
So I was kind of proud of the fact that he thought I was more valuable to the battery than he was. He was a battery executive officer.
So, wow.
Anyway.
I guess the last thing I would ask is, what do you want people to know about you and the folks who served in the battalion with you, folks who are listening?
Well, I guess I'd want them to know that we did what we thought was the best thing to do to get the war over with, and to get it over with favorably, and stop stuff like Nazism and things like that. Mm. And and keep the country as it is, free and democratic. I don't mean Democrat as a party, I mean,
yeah.
And a lot of people say,
democracy.
"Well, we're not a democracy, we're a republic." It doesn't make any difference what we are, but we have the right to vote and all of that stuff. And keep that. And that's why, I spend enough time in Germany that I know what Nazism is and what it did.
Do you worry about Nazism coming back at all?
I do. I just read something this morning, or yesterday, I think it was. I don't remember exactly what it was, but I was reading in the Anchorage paper about the swastikas they were putting on a Jewish center in a gay bar, I believe it was. And So, I'm concerned about it. Yes. Yeah.
That's all for this week's Kenai Conversation. A huge thank you to Al Hirschberger for sharing his story with us. You can listen to this conversation online at kdll.org. I'm Sabine Pooks. Thanks for tuning in.